You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Okay, I think we're all set. So let's dive in. Thank you all for coming this morning to what is going to be a really interesting and important panel about an event of huge consequence. Washington is a little distracted right now by Russia, but I think that the lens is going to swing back very quickly to Iran at the end of this week. As you all know, we have the Iranian presidential election on Friday. On that same day, Donald Trump will depart for Saudi Arabia and Israel, where we can be certain that Iran is going to be high on the agenda. And on Thursday, to complete the picture and build the drama, Trump has to decide whether he will issue waivers for certain sanctions that were lifted as part of President Obama's nuclear deal. And I know that Obama officials, former Secretary of State John Kerry and people who have worked for him are very nervous about what Trump might do. In fact, they've sort of formed an official-sounding group to try to lobby to make sure that Trump honors the nuclear deal and does waive the sanctions. I don't know how much of a difference it will make, but I think it reflects disquiet on the part of the Obama team about what he might do. And obviously, we know that Iran looms very large in Donald Trump's foreign policy. One of the first major events we saw from this administration was National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, now dearly departed, putting Iran on notice personally from the White House briefing room podium in sort of a dramatic statement. Although we'll talk about Trump and the nuclear deal, interestingly, there actually hasn't been a lot of follow-through on the part of the Trump administration, and certainly no great effort to dismantle the nuclear deal. So I should have started by introducing myself. I'm Michael Crowley. I write about foreign affairs for Politico, and I'm honored to be hosting this panel. I'm now going to introduce the panelists very quickly. We're going to dive in. They're going to give some brief opening statements. We're going to have a conversation and then take a lot of your questions, so be thinking about what you want to ask. So to the far left here is Mehdi Kalaji. He is the Libitsky Family Fellow at the Washington Institute, focusing on the politics of Iran and Shiite groups in the Middle East. There are longer bios that I won't read in the programs you were given. To my left is Suzanne Maloney, Deputy Director of the Foreign Policy Program here at Brookings, Senior Fellow in the Brookings Center for Middle East Policy and Energy Security and Climate Initiative, where her research focuses on Iran and Persian Gulf energy. And Karim Sajjadpour, who is a senior fellow next door at the Carnegie Endowment. So Mehdi, I think we're going to give the floor to you for some opening remarks. Then we'll hear from the others, and then we'll have a conversation before questions.
Okay, thank you. Hello, everyone. Iranian regime is, by nature, undemocratic system, government. Some people like Ayatollah Montazeri, famous cleric who was supposed to succeed Ayatollah Khomeini, has once said that Islamic Republic is neither Islamic nor Republic. This kind of government is described by political scientists by different name, you know, semi-totalitarian regime, authoritarian electoral system, and so on. So why, therefore, it's very difficult to find someone, an independent observer, who believes that the election in Iran is fair and free. More importantly, the majority of, you know, reformist supporters of Khatami, supporters of Rouhani, they believe the election in Iran is not fair and it's not free. So why people are so enthusiastic about participating in the election? One reason might be the traumatizing experience of 2009 uprising, or so-called Green Movement. Green Movement was successfully suppressed by the government, but its impact still remains and plays an important role in political psychology of Iranian people. Not only that Green Movement experience, but also heavy, unprecedented economic sanctions, in addition to economic mismanagement of Ahmadinejad government, and corruption, massive corruption, all made people's life so bad. When Rouhani came, many people have a failed experience of reforming the regime, changing the regime. Some people wanted to change the regime. Some people wanted to somehow modify or affect the hardcore of the government. This attempt has failed. On the other hand, out of this failed attempt, a very populist and delusional president won the election, like Ahmadinejad. When Rouhani became this president 4 years ago, he symbolized a hidden concession between the urban middle class who tried to change the regime and failed with the government. So Rouhani was the point that most of those people who participated in the Green Movement were agree upon him with, and shared the same feeling with the government. Government and people, they agreed upon Rouhani. And this time we have the same thing. People think that the regime change is not an option at all. Why? For different reason. Because the government is so skillful in suppressing civil society, any social network, and so on. On the other hand, the experience of Arab Spring did not turn very well. And we have, a region which is chaotic. So for people, and people, Iranian people, were suffering from, a very critical economic situation. Therefore, if in 2009, the urban middle class were looking for, ideals like democracy, human rights, women's rights, secular government, now it's totally changed. Since 4 years ago, they gave their place to two major demands, economic prosperity and security. And they are so happy that this government is not democratic. This government is very intolerant, but at least it's strong enough to protect the stability and integrity of Iran. And on the other hand, we have someone like Rouhani, who comes from within the government and decreases the economic pressure on Iran. So election became the only window, though small, the only window to make life a little bit easier, but with zero cost. Other options are unaffordable because of their high cost, and in practice may lead to undesired result, as it happened in 1979, when Iranian overthrew Shah. They thought that, when Shah leaves the country, they're going to have automatically a democratic, government. But, that experience also is quite alive in social memory. I stop here.
Great. Thank you all very much for coming. And maybe I'll start off broad. I don't want to assume too much knowledge and happy to go into more detail in the Q&A. So I think what's unique about Iranian elections globally is this combination of being unfree, unfair, and unpredictable. Not many elections you can say that about. I think their Iranian elections are always designed to produce maximum drama and minimum change, and that certainly has been the case over the last few decades. The presidential elections have oftentimes been quite dramatic, especially in 2009. But I would say the long-standing strategic principles of the Islamic Republic have changed very little over the last three, four decades. There, as Mehdi alluded to, authoritarian regimes don't have democratic elections, so these elections are rigged ahead of time. And the big question will be, to what extent will they be rigged after the vote and in the ballot counting? I would say it's essentially a two-man race, and you don't have to be gender neutral when it comes to Iranian politics. It's always only men who are allowed to run. So it's a two-man race between the incumbent, Hassan Rouhani, and his chief competitor, Mr. Raisi, Ibrahim Raisi. I would say in some ways it's an election between the status quo, who is Rouhani, and status quo ante, and Ibrahim Raisi, who is really kind of a mini-me of the Iranian supreme leader. He not only resembles very much the supreme leader, and he's from the same hometown, Mashhad, as the supreme leader, but his talking points, both in terms of domestic politics and his foreign policy, are nearly identical to that of the supreme leader. I think one of the challenges that all Iranian presidential contenders have is that there's two diametrically opposed audiences. On one hand, you have a very young, vibrant Iranian population which wants to be part of the outside world. So presidential candidates have to appeal to that constituency. And then you have, at the same time, the supreme leader and the Revolutionary Guards, whom you in some ways have to reassure. And it's very difficult to kind of reconcile your messages because the things these two constituencies want to hear are very different. Now, I would say from the perspective of the Iranian population, I would say that the Iranian population wants to be South Korea, not North Korea. You know, they want to be economically prosperous and integrated with the outside world. So in that context, Hassan Rouhani's message is more appealing. You know, the nuclear deal was something he delivered on. Obviously, people are upset that the economic deliverance of the nuclear deal hasn't been what they expected, but at least they see in Rouhani someone who, by and large, kind of shares their vision for Iran as opposed to Raisi. So I would say at a popular level, as many polls, and there's few independent polls in Iran, but certainly the polls that have been conducted up until now show Rouhani as a pretty comfortable lead, double-digit lead over Mr. Raisi. And I would also argue there's a strategic case, if you're the supreme leader, to keep Hassan Rouhani and his foreign minister, Javad Zarif, in place, because it's much more difficult for the United States to isolate Iran internationally when you have a more moderate foreign minister and president. That was much easier when you have the likes of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as president. So there's a strategic case for the supreme leader keeping Rouhani and Zarif in place. At the same time, I remember having now flashbacks to our elections here last November, and I remember a lot of the Obama folks and Hillary folks who answered when some expressed concern or even the possibility that Trump might win, they called them bedwetters. I don't know if you guys remember that, but so I want to also, you know, perhaps reveal myself as a Raisi bedwetter, and that I do think, despite what some of these polls say, that there is a possibility that he will win, not necessarily because he will receive more votes, but they will rig the election in his favor. As I mentioned, this for the supreme leader, having a president who is totally obsequious to him may be an attractive option. At the same time, the regime may feel that there is an opportune environment in which to rig elections. Number one, in 2009, there was a popular uprising which was crushed in Iran, so they may feel that the population is not about to react by rising up if they feel the vote was rigged. Number two, Iranians look at what's going on in the region, in Syria and Yemen and elsewhere, and the regime may feel that the population wants stability and security. They're not going to rise up. Number three, the Europeans and much of the outside world sees ISIS as the main problem in today's Middle East, not Shia radicalism in the form of Iran and Hezbollah, so there's not a European or international appetite to isolate Iran. And number four, the United States is so focused internally, and the Trump administration has articulated a policy of putting U.S. interests before U.S. values. The final point I'll make has to do with U.S. policy and what is likely to happen in the event of both the Rouhani and the Raisi victory. In the event of a Rouhani victory, I don't think it really changes the thinking of the Trump administration that much vis-a-vis Iran. I think one of the notable differences between the Trump administration and the Obama administration is the fact that whereas the Obama administration's main interactions with Iran were with the Iranian foreign ministry, it was, you know, John Kerry texting on a frequent basis with Iranian foreign minister Javad Zarif and meeting with foreign ministry officials, the Trump administration's views about Iran have been very much shaped by their interactions with the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, people like General Mattis, General McMaster, the folks in charge of the Iran file at the White House. Almost all of them served in Iraq, and they hold the Iran and the Revolutionary Guards directly responsible for over 1,000 U.S. casualties. So I think they start from a position of enormous cynicism vis-a-vis Iran, and that isn't likely to change even if Hassan Rouhani is reelected. Now, if Raisi wins, I think that they will feel, the U.S. will feel even more justified in its cynicism towards Iran. I think it will make it easier for Washington to make the case to Beijing, Brussels, and to some extent Moscow that Iran is a malign actor. And lastly, what I'll say is that if Ibrahim Raisi wins, I think the nuclear deal is orphaned. The main architects of the nuclear deal, Barack Obama and Hassan Rouhani, will have left the scene, and I think the survivability of the nuclear deal will be even less than what it currently is. So I'll stop there.
Thanks, Karim. Suzanne?
Thanks so much, Michael, and thanks to you, especially on this busy and exciting morning in Washington politics and international affairs, for joining us, and thanks to all of you. It's a kind of unpredictable, exciting time in Washington. But Iranian elections have a way of being both unpredictable, as Karim said, and surprisingly exciting, despite the fact that this is not a fully unfettered or anything close to free and fair competition. It's rigged from the start, and the only question is to what extent it may be rigged in the outcome. Nonetheless, I think it's important to sort of start with a kind of bedrock, which is that elections matter in Iran. They matter both as kind of critical junctures for the regime in terms of policy changes, but also mobilizing opportunities for the population. Iranians value political voice. They don't have an opportunity to make any kind of realistic impact on the selection of the supreme leader in most cases, but this election actually offers them, at least de facto, the possibility of doing so. Because one of the candidates in the race, the individual who's now the primary challenger to the incumbent Hassan Rouhani, is in fact touted as someone who could be a successor to the supreme leader. And that, of course, is the position that holds ultimate authority in Iran, the position that holds controls the levers of power, particularly the judiciary, use of force. And these are the things that really have constrained Iran's evolution from its inception as a revolutionary theocracy to something that might, in fact, meet the demands and expectations of a disproportionately young population that very much believes that they have some right to accountability in their own government. Rouhani, as I said, is the incumbent. He ought to be well positioned for a second term. I think if you had asked any of us a few months ago, we would have said it was a cakewalk. In fact, I think Karim and I both did from the stage a few months ago, simply because every Iranian president has, in fact, won his reelection if he survived his first term in office. That's happened even when the regime had to engage in sort of explicit and unambiguous manipulation of the results, as in the 2009 re-election of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. So that precedent alone should situate Rouhani reasonably well, but also the fact that he has a track record which should endear him both to the system as well as to the population. Most Iranian presidents, because of the limitations on the authority of the office, come away from their first term in a position of some frustration. They don't have a lot of tangible achievements to point to. Rouhani campaigned in 2013 on changing Iran's approach to the nuclear crisis at that time, and in fact, producing a relief of sanctions, and he has in fact achieved that. Now, of course, the criticism that he has faced from the population is that the trickle-down effects, the peace dividend that Iranians anticipated from that diplomatic breakthrough has not really shown up on their dinner tables yet, and that's been the sort of focus of the campaign debate that we've seen so far to date. Why is it that the nuclear deal hasn't produced the grandiose benefits that Rouhani himself promised? We can talk about that in a little bit more detail, but I would say fundamentally Rouhani overpromised in selling what was, I think, a vision of Iran's unfettered rehabilitation, when in fact the deal was very much a transactional relief from specific measures and never intended to be a wholesale get-out-of-jail-free card. But Rouhani ought to be have some value for the establishment, the political establishment within Iran. Iranian presidents tend to come into conflict with the system. We've seen this happen, in almost every prior case, whether it's Rafsanjani, Khatami, Ahmadinejad. They all, by the end of their first term, have run up against the constraints on their authority, are chomping at the bit, and often in conflict with elements of the establishment. Rouhani has navigated his course really carefully, and it comes from a career as an insider, a revolutionary functionary who also had experience in parliamentary politics, and so he knows how to campaign pretty cleverly. And he has avoided a lot of the mistakes of his predecessors in terms of fully alienating either the security bureaucracy or the office of the Supreme Leader. He's wholly disregarded the sorts of promises he made on the campaign trail in very vague terms deliberately in 2013 about political reform and significant changes to the kind of social restrictions within Iran. He's focused on economic reform, which I think was in fact the mandate that he had from the establishment. And while it hasn't fully succeeded, he can claim some significant achievements, particularly the reduction of the inflation rate by very dramatic levels. But the fact that Rouhani has faced the competition that he has, that this has not been a cakewalk, that in fact the outcome remains very much uncertain as we now sit 72 or 96 hours before the actual outcome of the ballot, I think leads to this sort of question about what this election is about. And that comes back to the candidate who is now his sole remaining serious competitor, Ibrahim Raisi. Raisi's place in the pecking order for future succession is really not known with any certainty by anyone. It's been intuited by the fact that he suddenly emerged from the bowels of the Iranian judiciary, having intersected with some of the bloodiest moments in Iran's repression of its own citizenry, to circulate in the Iranian press over the course of the past 2 years as a potential contender, to receive a plum position a little over a year ago as the administrator of the most wealthy and longest-standing and important Iranian religious shrine in Mashhad, a position that is important within the clerical hierarchy. And of course, the other factor that leads to this sort of sense of expectation around Raisi, not simply that his name, Raisi, is nicely alliterative with the Persian word for president, but in fact that the conservatives and principalists really coalesced to try to muscle any kind of serious competition out of the race. It was clear that Raisi was the chosen candidate. They had learned the mistakes of 2013. They were going to back a single horse, and Raisi was that individual. Now, there was a kind of wrinkle to this entire narrative, which was the continuing presence until yesterday of a third serious contender. The mayor of Tehran, who was making his third run for the office of the presidency, Mohammad Bakar Kalibaf was someone, I think, who stood no prospects of actually being elected. But his presence in the race would have driven the election itself almost certainly into a runoff ballot, between Rouhani and either Qalibaf or Raisi. My own interpretation on Sunday would have been that this was a sure thing and it was going to be a kind of orchestration of the scenario that we saw in 2005, where a little-known hardliner finished second in the initial first-round balloting and, in fact, was able to mobilize that position to defeat a well-known and well-financed incumbent of sorts at that time, former President Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani. That was the election that brought us Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and I would have said a second round would have easily produced, or naturally, at least plausibly produced, an Ibrahim Raisi as president. Instead, we now face a head-to-head ballot on Friday, a stark choice for Iranians, and a stark choice really for the system as to what outcome it favors, because as we know, there are infinite ways for this election to be manipulated on the day and in the days of the counting of the ballot. I think what we're going to see over the course of the next few days is a clear indication of how Iran intends to engage with the world, whether the sort of strategic option of a friendly, smiling duo, Rouhani and Zarif, engaging with the world, trying to head off pressure from the Trump administration is the preferred strategy, or whether, in fact, Iran is truly sinking inward, regressing to a much more repressive time. If Ibrahim Raisi is elected, I think, as Karim said, we have not only the prospect of greater traction for the Trump administration's efforts to put pressure on Iran, but we have the open question of how Iranians react if, in fact, the outcome is perceived as illegitimate, as it inevitably will be by some corners of the population. And so I think, you know, what we're going to watch over the course of the next few days is going to be very interesting, unpredictable, and very much important to shaping how Iran evolves and how the U.S.-Iranian dynamic evolves. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you all three for setting the table so well. Let me follow up with a kind of Washington, with a very Washington-centric question, because I didn't hear too much about it when you talked about the issues at play in the election. I wonder to what degree Donald Trump and his presidency and the rhetoric coming from the White House and the State Department. Karim, I noted you mentioned quite accurately that Trump has put U.S. interests before U.S. values, and what we've heard repeatedly from this administration, both explicitly and implicitly, is that human rights have assumed a lower priority in American foreign policy. The one exception, actually, has been Iran, when Rex Tillerson came out and gave a statement, I think, a week or 2 weeks ago. They I think, sustained some sanctions that were waived under the nuclear deal. They certified Iran's compliance, and then Rex Tillerson came out and gave this very hawkish statement about Iranian aggression in the region and behavior that was very tough on the question of human rights in Iran. And it was sort of the one time we've heard the administration raise that issue. That's a digression from my question, though, which is, to what degree has Donald Trump been a factor in this election and more broadly United States foreign policy? I mean, do you think that the race might look different, any of you can jump in, if we had a President Hillary Clinton right now, who was no softy on Iran, but would have given a different context to all of this, I think?
I don't see any clear evidence that the new administration and the rise of Trump, President Trump, had any significant impact on the both government officials and decision makers with regard to the election, or on the people's decision to participate in the election or vote for any of the candidates. Because now, if you look at the, for example, three televised presidential debates, the whole debate was focusing on economy. And in economy, there was two issues, corruption and mismanagement. And each of these people were accusing each other of, you know, being corrupt more than anyone else. Interestingly, you couldn't find any trace of Islamic ideological promises in this debate and in this campaign. Nobody tell people that if you come and vote for me, you're gonna certainly go to heaven, or you're gonna prove that you are a committed Shia practitioner, practicing Muslim, and you get some no religious reward or ideological reward is promised to people. It means that very dear friend Fuad Ajami has written a book on Musa Sadr, Imam Musa Sadr, and the title is Vanishing Imam. I could say that in Iran we have vanishing Islam. So Islam, is not Islam, and especially Islamic ideology is not attractive anymore. And also, there is no debate about the nuclear policy. Nobody talks about. It's like everyone assumed that okay, this is a deal made by Iranian government, blessed by Khamenei, and we have to, keep implementing.
Can I jump in there? Because that is a nice setup for the next question I was going to ask. And Karim, I'll come to you because you had a nice phrase about the nuclear deal being orphaned if Raisi wins. So what is the implication of that? I mean, if we wake up to a Raisi victory, presumably this is the Supreme Leader's decision at the end of the day, but is there some... To some extent, is this a referendum? Is he waiting to see how the vote comes out before making decisions about the nuclear deal? Or do you assume that the strong default is that the deal, that Iran abides by the deal, and unless Trump blows it up, and you might tell us, anyone here, if they expect Trump to blow it up, that it will continue in this sort of tense way?
Well, I want to be clear in saying that I don't think either side, either Washington or Tehran, is going to gratuitously tear up the deal, even if Raisi wins. I think the scenario I see more likely is that the deal unravels. It will be kind of death by a thousand cuts, particularly because of our various contentious regional differences with Iran. So one of the fundamental disputes about the nuclear deal is whether additional sanctions against Iran constitute a violation of the deal. The U.S. understanding is that we can sanction Iran. We can introduce previous sanctions that were lifted and harshen sanctions against Iran for other reasons, whether that's regional issues, human rights abuses, missile testing. Iran's understanding is that any additional sanctions would constitute a violation. So you could easily see a scenario whereby Iran does something, continues to do provocative things in the region against, especially it's notable the fact that President Trump's first overseas visits are to Saudi Arabia and to Israel. So Iran does something provocative vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia or Israel, we respond with additional sanctions. Iran responds by saying, you've just abrogated your end of the nuclear deal, and therefore we're going to reconstitute our activities. The Iranians are always shrewd enough not to go from 0 to 100, so they'll go from 0 to 20 in a way that will create rifts within the P5+1. So the United States will say, you've just violated your end of the agreement. The Chinese and the Russians will say, no, it's unclear, let's continue talking. But that's the scenario whereby I see the deal unraveling. And the difference is that, in a Clinton administration and the Rouhani administration, you'd have presidents in both capitals who felt that they were stakeholders in the deal, right? Both Hillary Clinton and Hassan Rouhani. If you have Raisi president and Trump president, you will have two individuals who are not stakeholders in the deal, who in many ways their campaign platform was criticism of the deal. So I don't think that they would feel a huge desire to uphold the deal. But I want to be clear that I don't think that either side will want to be blamed for the deal's unraveling. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So if we wake up Saturday and Raisi has won, it's not, we're on the path to war. It will be a more slow-rolling process if the deal unravels at all. Suzanne, maybe you would talk a little more, Raisi would be, Rouhani is a fairly known quantity, and so maybe let's just talk a little more about the implications of a Raisi win. And I just want to set you up by citing an article that Elliot Abrams, who was a former official in the Reagan, I think H.W. and W. Bush administrations, who has done a lot of work on the Middle East and was very nearly Deputy Secretary of State before, if you believe the reporting, Steve Bannon found out some things he had said about Donald Trump during the campaign and vetoed Rex Tillerson's preference to have Elliot be his deputy. Elliot wrote a piece for Politico that appeared this morning, which reminded me, it boils down to the phrase that Bibi Netanyahu used, I think, at the United Nations and possibly many times, which is that Ahmadinejad was a wolf in wolf's clothing and Rouhani is a wolf in sheep's clothing, and the world was better off being able to see the wolf for what he is. And Abrams was essentially making this argument. He said he's indeed rooting for Raisi, that he will reveal the true face of the Iranian regime, that Rouhani is a phony moderate. So I guess my question to you is should we expect Raisi, if he wins, to kind of let it rip? I mean, is it going to be Ahmadinejad all over again? Are we going to be hearing about Holocaust denial? Are we going to be hearing the most bellicose anti-Semitic rhetoric that we recall from the mid-2000s. And one other point he made I'd be interested in hearing you respond to is his prediction was that a Raisi win would inevitably spark a new round of protests because the Iranian public, at least the metropolitan public, would perceive it to have been a phony, rigged outcome. So what is your reaction to those to that, and also, again, on this question of how Raisi will sort of perform on the public stage if he does win and suddenly there's a huge amount of focus on his every word?
I think the latter half of your question is the harder part to answer. Simply, we don't really have a good sense of how Raisi will present himself to the world. This campaign has really been his first opportunity to present himself to the Iranian nation. And he's done so in a way that, as Karim said, is almost in a sort of marionette-like fashion to the themes and words and speeches of the Supreme Leader. He's directly in line with everything that is a sort of official mantra for the clerics within the system. How that translates into, you know, him behaving independently as president, I think, is very difficult to predict, much in the same way that, you know, no one anticipated in 2005 that Ahmadinejad would sort of become this manic figure on the international stage, someone who'd be lampooned on Saturday Night Live and you know, a kind of cartoonish caricature of a madman leader. So I suspect that the Iranian leadership has learned its lesson from that experience, and that Raisi would be far more disciplined. But I think they're, you know, all bets are off when and if he were to get into office. In terms of Elliot's op-ed and why it is that some in Washington and elsewhere might actually prefer a Raisi victory, it's perfectly understandable. Ahmadinejad was the gift that keeps on giving. This came as a surprise to the Bush administration, to be quite honest. They didn't really know what they were getting in Ahmadinejad, in part because, in what may be a parallel to the current moment, there was just this presumption that Rafsanjani's slick, he's good with the Europeans, of course they're going to keep put him back in place at that time. He'd been out of the presidency for 8 years at that point. And so, you know, the idea that Ahmadinejad was going to be this sort of unknown figure, it wasn't until he came on his first visit to the United Nations in September of 2005, went back to Iran, talked about seeing a bright light and feeling the spirit of the imam speaking directly to him and to those assembled in the audience in a way that discredited him at home. His speech at the UN discredited him or helped to generate the case for referral of the Iranian nuclear issue to the UN Security Council. And after that point, every visit that Ahmadinejad wanted to make to the United Nations was quickly greenlighted by the Bush administration, because it was quite clear that every time he was outside of his element, he had a tendency to galvanize opposition to Iran in a way that no other party could do. And Raisi has this incredibly bloody record, and really in a way that is deeply shameful, that he is in fact a plausible figure to lead the Iranian executive branch at this stage in time.
So by that, he oversaw mass executions, people hung from cranes a half dozen at a time all day long.
He was one of four judges, and I know Mehdi's itching to get in on this, but I want to emphasize it's not just this 1988 episode, which resulted in the deaths of thousands of political prisoners, but also later episodes of repression, student protests in 1999, some of the response to the Green Movement and some of the worst torture and abuse of Iranian dissidents in Iranian prisons. All these things are part of Raisi's métier. And this is the sort of frame of reference that he brings to the Iranian presidency. He's not been, you know, sort of part and parcel of broader debates about how to run the country. He's not been, in a way, in any significant fashion, confronted with serious economic decisions. He comes with the frame of reference of a hanging prosecutor, and it is deeply worrisome.
Eti, do you want to give us a quick thought on that, and then I have a question for you on a different subject, but if you want to
finish that off. We can talk about the details of the life history, and political records, but I think regardless to the identity of the president, the position of president is very important to look at, because no matter who's the president, the Ayatollah Khamenei's apparatus, meaning state radio and TV, judiciary, intelligence, armed forces, all this gigantic organization, powerful organization can weaken him. Whether it's Ahmadinejad or Khatami or Rafsanjani or Rouhani, anyone. And now, don't think that if Rouhani wins, he got this victory easily. According to the polls today, I saw Raisi and Rouhani, they are very close. They are less than 50%, both of them. Why? Many people, yes, we look from Washington and, think that Rouhani was successful because, he succeeded in the negotiation. But Iran is suffering from a serious economic crisis, the unemployment, the inflation, and many other things. So Rouhani has lost some of its social power base. And interestingly, when polls show that his support dropped, he started to, for example, before yesterday in Tabriz, he named Khamenei and he criticized him. So it means that if you want to become a popular candidate, you have to stand against Khamenei. This confrontation would weaken Rouhani more than anyone else. And his victory, yes, his record if you believe that his record in the first term was good, don't think that he can have the same kind of achievements and records in the second term. Second term, typically, Iranian presidents are much weaker.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you mentioned the Supreme Leader, and that's what I wanted to ask you about. Let me ask you about it, and Karim, I want to hear from you on this also, because I know you've looked closely at it as well. But the context here is that we have an election that is not fundamentally free and fair. The candidates are essentially vetted. We don't trust that the vote itself will be on the level because it's the Supreme Leader who runs the country. So the Supreme Leader is 78 years old. I think there's some ambiguity about his exact date of birth. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Not he himself mentioned the exact time.
He did. Okay. Well, okay. So I'm wrong about that. But
I live with him every day.
Okay. I'm going to defer to you on that. But he is no spring chicken. He is not skiing and hiking and going for runs. As far as I can tell, I think he had some health issues a few years ago. So you can get what I'm driving at. Talk about what happens if we wake up tomorrow or in a couple months and the Supreme Leader is no more. What do the next days and weeks look like?
I'm writing his political biography, and now it's been many years, and everyone is frustrated about it, including a famous journalist in this town. Recently, she told me that, hurry up, let's get this finished before Khamenei dies or you die.
Right, and by the way, people waited for Castro to die for a very long time, and he disappointed them until...
That's exactly the point. We don't know exactly how is his health condition, because that's a security matter. As we didn't know about Ayatollah Khomeini, his predecessor, as we didn't know about Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi until the cancer was progressed. The point is, we don't know what happened after Khamenei because deliberately he didn't want to mention or suggest or allude to someone as his successor. Because we had this experience under Khomeini and in turn disastrous. Ayatollah Montazeri was appointed by the Assembly of Experts as Khomeini's successor. And he started to build up his own empire and compete with Khomeini. So he doesn't want, especially because he's much weaker than Khomeini, he doesn't want to see, you know, somebody to create someone as his rival. On the other hand, Khomeini doesn't have the same legitimacy that Khomeini had. And at the time of Khomeini, still people were living in the ideological atmosphere. It was the 8 years of Iran-Iraq war. Many people, ordinary people, were loyal to Islamic ideology, and the government was not that corrupt that we see today. Now, especially the new generation, they believe almost in nothing. And they are just rebels. And that's why, from one perspective, Iran is going toward a social situation like Eastern European countries at the end of communist period. So Khamenei, when dies, it's very naive to think that 86-year-old Ayatollah, who were appointed by himself, would sit together and appoint his successor. Don't forget that Khamenei owns an economic empire, which is not accountable before the government or before the parliament. So it's a big asset. For example, the Shrine of Imam Reza, which is now its custodian is Raisi, is the largest religious endowment in Muslim world. It's a big asset. On the other hand, Khamenei is commander-in-chief of armed forces. So when he dies, naturally, these commanders, senior commanders, won't allow these clerics who know nothing about politics, about the military affairs, about the management, to appoint their boss. They want to have a role in the process of the decision-making. There are several scenarios that could be imagined. None of them are good. I think one scenario is that Khamenei dies and the decision makers, which are different organizations, entities like IRGC, clerics, conservatives, judiciary, they fail to reach to an agreement and make a consensus rapidly. So in this case, there will be a committee consists of three people. One is president, one is chief of judiciary, another one is a member of the Guardian Council selected by the Expediency Council. But the Constitution doesn't say when this committee expires. So it can go on and on and on. And because, for example, today, Rouhani belongs to one political camp. The chief of judiciary is the opposite. They wouldn't be able to make any significant decision on key issues. So you would see that, especially on the foreign policy, on the nuclear policy, on the military policy, the government becomes paralyzed, unable to change the course. This is one scenario. The other, which is very dangerous, because, for example, if it takes more than 4 years, there will be a presidential election. The president should be changed.
And give us one other scenario, and then we're going to go to questions. Or maybe I'll interrupt you there. I'm sorry. Well, Karim, do you see another scenario that he didn't mention before we go to the audience?
Well, just he's 77, but you know, when I watch his speeches, he seems in good health. A southern gentleman once suggested to me that maybe Khamenei has a paleo diet to complement his paleo worldview. But I think Mehdi is right that the Revolutionary Guards will play an outsized role. And what oftentimes happens, both in Iran and the Middle East, is when they're looking for leadership or succession, it's the lowest common denominator individual with the least amount of enemies. That was the case of Khamenei himself, Karzai in Afghanistan, Maliki in Iraq. So it may well be someone who is not on any of our radars just because they have the least amount of adversaries.
Okay, I think we are about the time for questions. So let us know if you have one. You got there first, and then I'll go to you. Is there a mic coming around? There's a mic coming. Just introduce yourself, please.
Thomas Panuma with Stratus Advisors. What are some modest but nevertheless substantive steps that the Trump administration could take to engage with the Iranian government? Or do you think that that is even, it seems that the administration doesn't have any diplomatic vision whatsoever, so I'm curious about that.
Is there any appetite to engage with the Iranian government? Do you see the possibility of some back channel hand to accompany the public fist?
I don't think that that's the natural instinct of the team that's been put in place. I see, in fact, the opposite, that at least at the very senior level, Trump has put in place a national security leadership that is united around one singular idea, perhaps disparate ideas on other major challenges and issues, but united around the idea that Iran is the root of the problems in the Middle East, and that Iran's regional expansion over the course of the nuclear diplomacy is, in fact, the greatest threat to U.S. interests and allies in the region. And so this is very much a kind of change in the narrative that the Obama administration had, obviously. It also, I think, is a change in the frame of reference. For the Obama administration, necessarily, Iran was approached as a nuclear crisis. This oftentimes created backlash. Particularly, I often heard from Iranian Americans who said that shouldn't be the primary concern. That should be somewhere, you know, behind human rights issues and other concerns. But the nuclear issue was necessarily the primary frame of reference for Obama administration policy toward Iran. Any successor to the Obama administration, once the deal was done, was going to have a different frame of reference. And for this administration, it is very clearly Iran's regional activities. That is, to some extent, a function of the fact that so much of the senior national security team in the Trump administration comes from a military background and has direct exposure, as Karim said, to Iran's activities, malign activities in Iraq and Afghanistan. But it's also, I think, a function of the rising tide of concern that paralleled the nuclear diplomacy in the region about what Iran was doing, not simply in its financial and materiel support to the Assad regime, but in creating a kind of Shia expeditionary army to help wage that war, in stepping up the lethality and the intensity of its support to other proxies and militias around the region. These were not policies that were, in fact, provoked by the nuclear diplomacy. They were opportunistic reactions to chaos and violence in the region. But the fact that they were largely relegated to secondary or even lower concern during the Obama administration because of the nuclear diplomacy meant that they were going to rise to the top level. So I don't see a sort of inclination to engage, but I do think that we are in a different era as a result of the nuclear diplomacy. It has become routinized to have direct diplomatic contact from the Iranian side, and that was always the holdup. Every prior American president, Republican and Democrat, sought to engage with Iran, and for the most part had difficulty in persuading the Iranians to do so in a public and authoritative way. And that taboo was broken as a result of the nuclear diplomacy by Rouhani and Zarif. And I think it would be very hard for the Iranians to put back in place. We may toy with it from our side briefly, as the Bush administration briefly toyed, the George W. Bush administration briefly toyed with trying to cut off any direct engagement with Iran. But ultimately, the circumstances of the region will force us to come face to face with the Iranians. I just tend to think it will be in a more confrontational fashion.
I would agree with everything Suzanne said and just add a couple points. One is, I think an important or interesting first test for the Trump administration will be this Boeing airplane deal, because in some ways it's a clash of his domestic policy vision and the foreign policy views of his administration, in that the Boeing deal is part of the nuclear deal. Boeing is supposed to be allowed to sell Iran dozens of airplanes. And Boeing has made the case that this is going to create hundreds of jobs and raise a lot of money for American industry, something that Trump has spoken very favorably about. And Boeing has taken out full-page ads and newspapers praising the wisdom of President Trump. On the other hand, Trump's national security brain trust and members of Congress are very exercised about the idea of providing Iran more airplanes, which they could theoretically use to arm Hezbollah and Assad. And I think the second question, which the administration will have to think about Iran's role in, is ISIS, and how do you counter ISIS? Is Iran the arsonist in the fight against ISIS, or the fire brigade? You know, do they fuel ISIS, given their support for Assad and Shia militias both in Iraq and Yemen, or is, you know, enlisting the support of Shia radicals to kill Sunni radicals actually tactically expedient? I don't think that's something. In some ways, I feel like there's a distinction between President Trump and many of his advisors on this issue. So it remains to be seen.
Yeah, and let me just add on that myself, if I may. It's been interesting to see the Trump administration say some, they're vague, but some receptive things about the latest Russian-led peace initiative in Syria and this idea for to have de-escalation zones, while at the same time complaining that Russia has to work to reduce Iranian influence in Syria, because Iran is a party to this process and will essentially have to be a party to almost any kind of a peace deal. So it seems like the Trump administration is trying to do two things at once that are in tension, and they have not resolved that tension, working with Iran to stabilize Syria working with Russia in the near term to stabilize Syria would seem to imply working at least indirectly with Iran, and that is a rock and a hard place for them. Mehdi, did you want to jump in on this point before the next question?
Any engagement has to be relying on both parties' willingness. You know, we can ask about Trump's willingness to engage with Iran, but we can reverse the question and ask the next president's willingness to, whether Rouhani or Raisi, to engage with the United States. I think that this is Ayatollah Khamenei who designed and enforced the main foreign nuclear military policies, and the president only implemented. So since Ayatollah Khamenei, I don't think that he would change his position on United States or Israel. I think the only time we can expect some transformational change in Iran's foreign policy is after his death.
Great. Next question, right there.
Thank you for your remarks. Maria Langen-Rieckhoff from here at Brookings. Suzanne, if I understood you correctly, in your opening remarks, you said something about a Raisi win could be an indication of kind of an inward turn for Iran. And so kind of two questions out of that. I was curious, if that's true, what kind of forces and factors within Iran, the region, or more globally could be pushing Iran toward a more inward focus? And if that happens, what does an inwardly focused Iran look like? How does it change their engagement within the region?
Those are really good questions. You know, my interpretation of a Raisi win as a sort of turn inward is in explicit contrast to what Rouhani has sought to do, which is to bring Iran back into the world, to capitalize on the nuclear deal as an avenue for Iran's rightful stature in the international diplomatic community, but also, of course, in terms of bringing back foreign investment and trade to Iran. Raisi has, on the campaign trail, emphasized the kind of idea of resistance economy, that we need to be self-sufficient, which is an enduring part of the Iranian revolutionary narrative, something that Khamenei himself has emphasized substantially. But much more, I think, on the grounds of the cultural threat that is presented by wholesale integration into the international economy. So my presumption is that a Raisi-led Iran would be far less engaged in trying to lure European and Asian companies to invest in Iran, would be looking for ways to strengthen domestic industries, would be more protectionist and less engaged in the very sorts of return to other international fora, whether it's the Shanghai Cooperation Organization or this other kinds of international organizations that Iran has sought to assert itself in as a way of staking its claim as a rising regional power. In terms of Iran's regional activities, like Karim, I don't see a tremendous shift in the way that Iran approaches the Syria conflict, its role in supporting Houthis in Yemen, or some of the other malign activities across the region as a result of the presidential election. I do think that a Raisi win would provide enormous traction for the Trump administration in seeking to isolate Iran, not straight out of the bat, but over the course of his 4 years in office. I think it would be almost inevitable that we would see an increased incidence of repression at home, and potentially more of the kind of completely provocative statements that are made every day by elements of the regime. The Holocaust denial was not unique to Ahmadinejad, but his brazenness professing this kind of rhetoric around the Islamic world, as well as on international stages, I think was something that was quite unique and quite valuable in terms of creating a decision to isolate Iran.
Karim, I'm glad you've returned from occultation, as they call it. Take a question here.
Hi, my name is Mohammed Tahir from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. I was watching this debates in presidential debates in Iran, the situation of ethnic minorities. When I say that, I talk about Sunnis. They're popped up in a number of occasions. Rouhani was saying something and Qalibaf responding to him. So is it just the elections rhetoric, or something is changing in their states in general, in general in Iran, in Iranian society?
To take that.
So, I would be curious to hear what both Suzanne and Mehdi have to say. Mehdi was being trained as a cleric in Qom, so he has some profound thoughts on...
I'm a recovering Ayatollah.
I'd say a couple of things. One is that Iran, by virtue of the fact of this growing sectarianism in the Middle East, is being forced to be much more sensitive about the treatment of the Sunni population in Iran, which constitutes approximately 10%. But for years, Iran felt that it could kind of use the anti-Israel card, anti-US, anti-imperialist card to transcend the Sunni-Shia divide, the Arab-Persian divide. But particularly because of the uprisings in Syria, when on a daily basis Arab Sunnis see Alawite dictator backed by a Shiite regime killing Sunnis en masse, that's produced tremendous anti-Shia sentiments. And so I think Iran is in some ways more more sensitive to that. On the other hand, I find that a lot of these issues that are brought up about both lack of social freedoms, lack of political freedoms, lack of freedoms for ethnic and religious minorities, are only brought up for about a one-week period every 4 years. After that, you don't really hear about it. So there is this kind of one-week period every 4 years when Iran and Iranian politicians are trying to appeal to their population. And that is kind of revealing because you hear them say things that they would say if Iran were a genuine democracy. So they talk about, you know, having greater social freedoms, et cetera. But if Raisi wins, or even if Rouhani wins, is improving the lot of ethnic or religious minorities in Iran going to be a number one or number two or even number three priority for them? I'm doubtful of that. Be curious what you say.
Yeah, Iranian constitution is the only constitution in Islamic world that clearly mentions a sect of Islam, Shia Islam, as the official religion of the country. So in Iran, you find various discriminations against different communities. Some of them are against Iranian law, but some of them are legal. Actually, discrimination against Sunnis is legal. Legally, they cannot take many jobs, and the government systematically pushed them out of public bureaus and, you know, the government, any sensitive job, and so on. So, but on the other hand, Iran has to portray itself as a sectarian government, because traditionally the ruler of Iran is also the head of Shia community. Okay, they have to emphasize on this. On the other hand, outside Iran, Iran portrays itself as a pan-Islamist or pan-Islamic government or entity. Iran's policy towards Sunnis has lots of contradictions and ambivalent attitude. Yeah.
Okay, time for a couple more questions. Did I promise you? Yep, okay, I'll get to you next. And remember to introduce yourself, please. Oh, yep, actually, a gentleman in the glasses.
I'm Ehsan Ebrahimi, economist with the IMF. I have a question anyone on the panel probably can address, especially Mehdi and Karim. So it seems to me that the Ayatollah Khamenei's succession is sort of the big issue in this election, which could affect the politics of the region and the country in the long term. So my question is, do we know sort of the set of people that are deemed to be potential candidates for this issue, besides Mr. Raisi and probably Mr. Shahroudi, who seems to be ill right now? So he seems to be in critical condition, especially given that my understanding of the Supreme Leader is that he's a very patient very patient with a lot of grit in pursuing his long-term objectives. So to me, it seems a bit suspicious that he's calm. He doesn't say much, at least up until now. He does not, has not talked or mentioned any of the candidates implicitly or explicitly. So how do you read his preferences and the set of people who are potentially can succeed him, given that, I mean, it seems to me very unlikely that he does not have thought about this and he does not have plans actually in place?
I've written on this issue several long pieces. There are four people whose name come up more than anyone else: Sadiq Larijani, Mojtaba Khamenei, Raisi, and Shahroudi. Recently, I published at the Institute, Washington Institute, a political profile of Hashemi Shahroudi, but he's not doing well. Yesterday morning, he has undergone a surgery for his advanced cancer, and, you know, probably he dies before Khamenei. But the issue is that it is impossible to speculate about the
identity of individuals who might be potential successor. There is a committee consist of three people in the assembly of experts. They are in charge of studying potential competent candidates. And interestingly, these three members of assembly of experts are not allowed to report on their studies to anyone, including the head of the assembly. And the only person on the earth who received the confidential report is Ayatollah Khamenei. But it doesn't say anything because these are just names. And we have to wait for the political dynamism after Khamenei, because it's important the time of his death, the political context of his demise, and who has more power. I think those power circles which exist now, they do their best to protect their interest after his death. But none of them is powerful enough to dominate other factions. They need to make a consensus. And this is the place that is very important. At if in a failure in making consensus may lead to chaos, crisis, and things like
that. Let me interject then. I think I promised a couple people, and we'll be about done. Maybe, Suzanne, I would ask you, we haven't really touched on the question of, well, let's say the Supreme Leader dies and there's chaos and confusion. How plausible is it that there would be essentially a counter-revolution? I mean, how brittle is the regime, and is it vulnerable to maybe not an overthrow when the Supreme Leader is still with us, although I'd be interested if you think that's plausible, but in the chaos after he dies that we have some kind of a more secular government that takes over? And do that briefly, because I know a couple of people have questions and we're running out of time. It's a big question, I'm sorry, but I think it's important to touch on it.
Yeah, and I think, look, this is Iran. Anything is possible, and any prediction we make today will almost surely be proven wrong within the span of days or some recognizable period of time. I would assume that given that Iran has only been through one prior instance of succession of its supreme leader, that the circumstances of the next supreme leader have been thought through very carefully. In addition to this committee, it's got to be uppermost in the minds of the supreme leader himself, particularly since the death of former President Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani earlier this year. He was about 5 years older than the supreme leader, but they were very much of the same revolutionary cohort, and so his own longevity has to be uppermost in his mind. And warding off just the scenario that you suggest, something that might approach chaos, would be the shared goal of every element of the system, particularly the security bureaucracy. I think what we don't know is not only who's on that list, and the short list that Mehdi said is one that is I think, widely shared, but who are the kind of key influencers who are going to make that decision? We know the institutions, we know the committees, but fundamentally, in 1989, it was Rafsanjani, and it was the son of the then late supreme leader, who got together and essentially said, this is what Khomeini wanted. And then it was sanctified by the assembly of experts. We don't really know at this stage who are the three or four people or five or six people who are going to be in the room to make that decision. And that, in a sense, is a kind of leadership race unto itself.
And just quickly, I mean, it's a big question, but quickly, in the interest of time, do you think the regime, beyond the leader, the governing structure is brittle enough? Kareem, you're nodding your head a little bit. Do you want to do like a two-sentence answer, brittle enough that it could collapse under the right circumstances? Or basically, does the IRGC sort of step in and take over if it comes to that?
Well, one thing I kind of drew from 2009, and this applies not only to Iran but other dictatorships, is that what's important for authoritarian regimes is not the breadth of your support but the depth of your support. And if you have a monopoly of coercion and a few hundred thousand people willing to go out and kill and die to preserve your power, I think they can sustain themselves. Ibn Khaldun said empires come and go in three generations. We're just entering the second generation of the Islamic Republic. But I would agree with something Mehdi said earlier, which is that I think I see Iran's evolution similar to that of post-Soviet Russia, which is that the official ideology has been bankrupted, the new ideology becomes consumerism, and whatever happens in Iran, even if there is a regime implosion, the people who then come to power are apparatchiks from the former regime. Putin was former KGB, and I could see the next leader of Iran, you know, even decades down the line, as a Revolutionary Guard alum.
That's very interesting. Okay, quick questions, and maybe one person answer briefly so we can get in. I think I've got three people lined up, so you're one. I see you. Was there someone else I said could ask a question already? Okay, so go ahead, please.
Okay, my name is Jack Kropansky, unaffiliated. How consequential is Syria in the election? Is this in any way going to be a referendum on Iran's involvement in Syria, and is it likely to change what Iran's involvement in Syria ends up being?
Brief unlike, answer, yes, please.
Unlike the nuclear negotiation, nuclear deal, which was quite popular in Iran, and that's why Rouhani is popular, Iran's regional policy is very popular, and not only among the supporter of the regime, but also in the, you know, Paris-based opposition, secular opposition, and if because they think that the objective of Iran's policy in the region is to protect Iran's stability and integration. So in last 4 years, we had two national heroes in Iran. One, Mohammad Javad Zarif, for conducting the negotiation successfully, and another one, Qasem Soleimani, for fighting against ISIS.
Great. There with the glasses, and we'll do you for the last question. Quick question, one answer, please.
Vince Alfonso for Lance Rider. I think, Karim, you mentioned the latest polls that they were close. I think the margin of victory, the margin of these polls is pretty important because of the division between the moderates and the conservatives. My question is, what about the younger generations in Iran, young people that are going to universities in science and technology, Iran's openness to education for women in schools? Can you maybe elaborate on the role of the young generation and how they could play a role in the elections? Thank you.
Millennials, are they getting their election news through Snapchat?
You know, we've been talking about the Iran's younger generations being, you know, leading change in Iran since at least 1997, the 1997 election, and I fear, unfortunately, they're going to continue to be very frustrated, and then they're going to grow into kind of middle age and say, well, and then they're going to err on the side of stability rather than going out into the streets. And that's actually one of the papers I'm authoring at Carnegie, is about Iran's demographics. And by regional standards, Iran isn't actually a very young population. By global standards, it is. By regional standards, it already had its youth bulge. And we know, you know, popular uprisings are more likely when you have young cohort of 18 through 25. So I don't see there being kind of an Iranian spring the same way we saw in Tunisia and elsewhere. And just on the polls, I think this is an important point, because the quote-unquote independent poll and the independent pollster that we're working with shows Rouhani with a very sizable lead. I didn't check it this morning, but yesterday was over 15 points. The Revolutionary Guards came out with their own poll, Fars News, showing Raisi has a 3-point lead. So I think that this, I read as kind of an ominous sign. So these polls, we'll have to go back once the election has been conducted and kind of cross-reference them.
Okay, and last question here, woman in the white jacket.
My name is Amal Mudallali. I'm with the Bridge International Group. My question actually was answered partly by Mr. Mahdi about Syria, but it's basically about the Iranian role in the region. The Arab leaders, when you talk to them, they say Iran deals with us, with Qasem Soleimani, and they deal with the West, with Rouhani and Zarif. I was wondering, after these elections, do you see any of that changing at all, or are we going to see the same pattern? And what would it take to convince Iran to... less in support to people like organizations like Hezbollah and the Houthis and stuff like that. What should happen, especially you talked about the dire economic situation. What would it take? Thank you.
Question. Suzanne, you want to take us home with that?
I'll try, although it's a big question. Look, Karim has said, and I'm sure Mehdi has said as well, Iran's strategic policy doesn't typically find significant alteration as a result of presidential elections. 2013 was an exception to that, in part because the election itself was used as a kind of critical juncture for the system to change its track in terms of dealing with the nuclear crisis. So I don't think there's any realistic expectation that Iran will alter its approach to the region as a result of a campaign or a vote. I think what drives Iranian policy is both opportunity and a sense of threat. And if those change, or if the price attached to its policies in the region changes, it's entirely possible for Iran to alter its approach. Those who suggest that the kind of commitment to Syria is an existential one, were also many of the same who were suggesting that the nuclear program was an existential commitment. And yet we saw that Iran could, in fact, make pragmatic compromises on the nuclear program, but only when the price became too high to continue on the track that it was on. So I think at this stage, you know, what's been interesting in the past couple of days is that Rouhani has started speaking about his desire to lift all the sanctions, which I think is a, you know, an implicit recognition of the frustration that the nuclear deal didn't produce, the dramatic change in the daily lives of Iranians, and a recognition that the residual sanctions regime that remains in place, despite the full compliance with the nuclear deal, still makes it very difficult for Iran to do business with the rest of the world. Rouhani, at a conference about 2 years ago, spoke of the sense that the regime had always used its economic weight to subsidize its foreign policy and bad domestic policies. And he said, we should reverse this. We should, in fact, use our foreign and domestic policies to help grow our economy. I don't know, and I wouldn't expect that if he gets a second term that he is, in fact, able to do that, simply because the ideological requirements and prerogatives that drive Iran's regional policies will not remain, will not change in any way.
Okay, a lot to think about, a lot to watch just in the next few days with the vote, the sanctions decision, Donald Trump's trip. So tune in. Hope you will be better informed as a result of this great panel. Thank you all for coming, for your good questions. Have a great day.